Welcome, everybody, to the first episode of Shortwave America. Today on the show, we're going to speak with Jerry Bryant from Full Circle Jesus Music. Jerry is a music veteran as well as a radio broadcasting veteran. Let's start off by telling you a little bit about Jerry. This from his bio page at FullCircleJesusMusic.com. Full Circle is a one-hour weekly Jesus Music show featuring classic music, artist interviews, ministry, and lots of memories. Full Circle is hosted by Jesus Solid Rock's Jerry Bryant, who pioneered one of the earliest and longest-running Jesus music syndications. Jerry was part of the early Jesus movement of the 70s. His Jesus Solid Rock concerts in Carbondale, Illinois, helped usher in early CCM to the Midwest. In 1978, Jerry became pastor of the Last Days community in Woodland Hills, California, with the legendary Keith and Melody Green. Then moved to Lindale, Texas, and worked with the Agape Force. Jerry ended up back in Carbondale, Illinois, and continued with his radio show and concerts before moving to Nashville in 1993. After an extended absence from radio, he's back doing what he loves to do, radio. On Full Circle, you'll hear fresh interviews from Matthew Ward of the Second Chapter of Acts, Randy Thomas from the Sweet Comfort Band, Sandy Brock from Servant, Phil Keggy, also known as the greatest guitarist in the world, Randy Stonehill, Melody Green, Scott Wesley Brown, Mylon LeFevre, and a whole lot more, plus great classic Jesus music from Love Song, Larry Norman, Keith Green, Kelly Willard, and so many more. So, let's get to the interview. We're excited to have him here.
Welcome to Full Circle with Jerry Bryant. Full Circle Radio. It's the classic Jesus music radio show. It's a look back at where it all began. This is Full Circle, looking back at the beginnings of today's contemporary Christian music. Now, here's your host, Jerry Bryant.
Hi, everybody. This is Jerry Bryant.
It's in Nashville, Tennessee that the sun has just set today, and we're just kind of enjoying a cool evening. And it's great to talk to you.
Well, thanks a lot. We appreciate you taking time to be here. As you know, this is the inaugural pilot episode of Shortwave America, which started on October 21st, 2008, and is just now becoming an audio episode and going from print only to print and audio, partnered with PCJ Media and PCJ Radio. So tell us a bit about Full Circle Jesus Music. Where did the inspiration for it come from, and how did you go about pursuing it and making it a reality?
Well, it really goes back a long, long time, because in 1972... that's a long time ago. I started a radio show called Jesus Solid Rock. I was in Carbondale, Illinois, attending Southern Illinois University, and had been there for a season getting a radio and television degree, and I was apprehended by the Living One himself. And I realized that a lot of people my age at that time really just did not have music that identified with our values or the style of music. I wasn't putting it down, but, you know, I just didn't enjoy quartets and choirs that much, and that was about all that was on Christian radio. But, of course, about that time, the Jesus Revolution was in full swing. I went out to Southern California and collected every album I could get hold of. I went to Expo 72, big event in Dallas, Texas area, and picked up my very first copy of the Love Song album. So I started a radio show with just a few albums and just started rotating the songs, and people were blown away. They had not heard the music of our time in that way. And so I guess some people called me one of the pioneers of contemporary Christian music, but back then we called it Jesus music. There were about maybe three, four shows at that time on air. I didn't find any Christian radio stations open to the process or, you know, the transition of that kind of music, but I did find some rock stations that would slip me in alongside Baba Ramdas or Timothy Leary or someone else as just another expression of people trying to find their way to God. But I eventually got kicked off those stations because I kept saying, well, you know, Jesus says he's the only way. And I was just repeating what he said. And they didn't quite appreciate that. But the rock and roll station in my hometown was open-minded to let me come on every Sunday night from about 9 o'clock till 2 in the morning. My collection grew, and so for many, many years, until I went to Southern California to be with Keith Green and his ministry, I did the Jesus Solid Rock Show. I think it was 1976. It was syndicated on 100 stations from coast to coast. So you see, the reason for my present show, Full Circle Jesus Music, might start making some sense, because I'm actually now going back into the archives, going back full circle, back to where it all began, and playing the music of the 70s and 80s. And so people now are listening to my show via the web, the iTunes store, or going to my website. And there are a number of Christian radio stations around the country, as well as Canada, New Zealand, Newfoundland, and other places that are using the program weekly on their radio stations. But I'd say most of my listeners are on the web. I get letters on the web from just about any country you can name who've been listening to the classic oldies on Full Circle, back to where it all began. That's kind of a short synopsis of how it all happened for me.
Well, that's a very neat history. You know, I was born back in 1977, so my earliest memories are, I guess you can say, when I was about 2 years old, you know, the summer and spring and so on of 1979. So listening to some of these older artists that I've gotten to hear over the years, one of the ones I got exposed to when I was in my very early teens, I must have been about 12 years old, was Mr. Randy Stonehill, someone you worked with on a couple of occasions over at Full Circle.
Oh, yeah, old Uncle Rand, because, you know, we first met when he would come over to Keith Green's house, where I was living at the Last Days Community in Woodland Hills, California, and he would write songs with Keith. We had all kinds of odd people coming through there, the second chapter of Acts and the Servant Band, and then Bob Dylan himself came over and wrote songs, and we got to talking with all these folks. And in the early days, I would interview those kind of people for my radio show, Jesus Solid Rock. And today I'm going back and I'm still interviewing the folks that I can still get in touch with and finding out where they are today. And your listeners could find the show by just simply going to FullCircleJesusMusic.com or looking it up on iTunes. You might find someone that you wanted to know where they are, what they're doing, and you'll find their websites are available, too, for some of that old music. And Randy is one of those guys who has just kept putting out great songs, great music, classic music, and you can go to his site and get a hold of his latest CDs by listening to my show or going to my website, where I have the links to a lot of these websites for these guys. And it's just so much fun replaying all the memories. And now we have a whole new opportunity now to reach people through shortwave. I mean, not to say that shortwave's new, it's been around a long, long time, but I really appreciate you inviting me on this particular broadcast, being one of your beginning broadcast, and I hope that you'll be very successful in what you're doing.
Thank you, Jerry. You know, shortwave, as you mentioned, has been around for quite a long time, and we're in an age now of a lot of aches and pains with shortwave broadcasting because of the fact that a lot of stations have gone dark. And being in the radio industry, you know that means that due to budgetary cuts, the shortwave services have either gone away or have been so limited that what you get to hear is sparse and far between compared to what you hear on the local dials wherever you might be in the world. And so that brings me to the question, back to those early 70s days, when Christian music was trying to make it its way into everybody's homes. And as Randy Stonehill once put it, everybody was asking, Christian contemporary what? What are they doing? And so it begs the question of, you know, you get to listen to all these different people talk sometimes from those days, and you get to listen to their music, and it paints something of a picture of what they might have been feeling and going through back then. But then you wonder what was going on in the radio industry at that time. Were they really having, you know, difficulty getting this stuff on the air, or were they just asking questions about whether or not it was acceptable for radio, or is there going to be a listener base here? What's the deal with that?
Well, really, all of those things played into it, and I was there, so I experienced it, as you would know. Even trying to get my radio show on some radio stations, the fact that some of my artists played guitar and had drums in their recordings was offensive to many people in the church at the time. Again, mostly you'll find that people respond to things that they're uncomfortable with fear or confusion. And it takes a while for that to, be alleviated by seeing the genuine lives of the people that I was representing. I was very, very careful to play artists as best as I could that were committed to their local church and to having a pastor and accountability. But needless to say, it was so new that still a lot of people would write me letters and saying, "You're not a Christian. You can't be. You're playing the devil's music." And so I'm sure that early radio stations were struggling with this changing of style of music because, as you know, many of their listeners were getting older and older. And then here comes a whole new wave, a whole new generation. And there just wasn't a lot for them on the radio at that time that they get identified with. So, yes, there was a lot of frustration in the early artists. First of all, they didn't even expect to get radio airplay, and so they weren't trying to get a record deal, and they would play anywhere anyone would let them, on the parking lot outside of Walmart, in a city park, or some church that was willing, you know, to take the risk. And so it was always for love only, and the message was, of course, that Jesus came to show us the most ultimate love through his sacrifice on the cross. It was very evangelical, very evangelistic. And there were not a lot of people trying, you know, to start an industry. But it did begin to happen in 78, 80, and 82. Some radio stations began to ask for the music. And so even custom songs would get occasionally an airplay. But folks like Billy Ray Hearn came along, and Billy Ray started the Sparrow Record Company. He had been with Word Records. Word was, of course, more of a middle-of-the-road record company, but Billy Ray had the vision to bring people along like Barry McGuire in the second chapter of Acts, and John Michael Talbot and Terry Talbot. Of course, that was the Talbot brothers. Originally had been the Mason Prophet Band, and Billy Ray probably more than anybody helped to bring the shift along where record companies were willing to take a risk. But they would always try to dictate at that time what the artist was going to play, and if it was just a little too rocky and the lyrics were a little bit over the edge, then they would try to kind of direct that, and not quite censorship, but they would try to say, well, you know, after all, we're kind of supporting this album financially, and you just kind of need to do it our way. And that really grated on a lot of the early contemporary artists. We called them Jesus music artists at that time, and then over the years we started calling it contemporary Christian music. So there was always a struggle at the beginning about how to find the balance. But then as they realized that they were really starting to sell these albums, and surprisingly enough, some were going silver and platinum, and they realized that they had really bought into an emerging generation or culture that they can make some really good money. And so unfortunately, in my own perception, and most artists would agree that business started to play a much bigger part than it should have. And unfortunately, the cost was that many of us felt that the gospel was watered down. And so some left, I'm afraid, with hurt and some anger about what had happened to them, because they would get dropped from a label because the next great pop artist was coming along. And even though somebody had pioneered the way, well, they just weren't very sought after as far as airplay. There were exceptions to that, of course. Keith Green, I think, could today be as popular as he was. And you had Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant and people like that. There were some exceptions that they would probably still be doing and are still doing well today if they choose to put out an album. But there were hundreds and hundreds of bands that just couldn't pay the bills. And finally, as they started having families and children, they either left the industry and started working in the church as a youth leader, or left the industry, or, you know, the church altogether. Some went and started working for the record companies and became a part of that whole structure. And so that's a little bit what has happened over the last number of years. But then we've gone through these seasons, especially lately, where the economy has really hit the industry in a very powerful way, to the point that many record companies had to fold. And we don't see nearly as many of the original companies still out there. They had to just give in to the fact that people weren't buying the albums like they used to. And so they cut drastically their artists and their companies until the point that they even closed. And so guess what's happened now? Independent companies are starting all over again, grassroots record companies. And some of them are doing some of the things that Keith Green did back in those days. They're making the album's available for whatever you can afford, a donation basis, which is pretty interesting in itself, because that's going to take some of the money away from the industry if you're selling your product versus giving it away and just trusting, you know, people for love offerings and the like. So I think we've seen just about everything that could happen in the Christian music era or genre that I could probably tell you many, many stories, but that's just a good, you know, overview or synopsis of what's happened.
Okay, so now we have all this that has gone on, and we have record companies saying, well, we're not making it. But just prior to that, where did the radio stations start picking up Christian music and saying, hey, we can do something with this, we can reach out to the families, there's an audience for putting these stations up and on the air and managing these things? And then you mentioned that there was a lot of upset artists out there in this whole thing, because the record companies were sort of watering down the message that they felt that they needed to be giving. So my question begins, where did the acceptance and all of this come from the radio stations, and how did that shift, and what played a role in that?
Well, I think that there were key people involved in that. There were more and more contemporary Christian music radio shows like myself. As I said, we were pioneers, the Scott Ross Show and myself, and the Joyful Noise with Paul Baker. But after a while, when more and more stations were having an hour of contemporary Christian music or Saturday night devoted to it, and then a lot more radio shows started, there were key individuals. Bob Augsburg is probably one of those. And Bob started a little station down in Florida around Naples. And that little radio station was so successful that he came and started a sister station here in Nashville. Then he went to Colorado and started another. At the same time, another network formed called the Salem Network and Love Radio Network. All of them realized the power of the multiplication that they could have through the satellite feed of one particular signal that would go to a lot of affiliates. And needless to say, some of the small stations would gladly become an affiliate because they didn't have to hire as many disc jockeys. They would have a national disc jockey on the air, very much like the news medias and some of the Radio One and different secular medias still do that. You know, Casey Kasem back with the American Top 40 and Dick Clark had something to do with this syndication idea. But now the Christian networks, Bob being one of them and others like him, helped to form large networks of hundreds of stations. John Rivers down in Dallas, Texas area, who had the Powerline show for so many years, and he was syndicated alongside my show. He formed or became part of a radio network. And so some of these early innovators then became, I don't know, if I want to use any kind of terms that come out of the mafia, but you know, they became the Dons, right? And they actually had a syndicate of many radio stations playing their songs and playing. And of course, then came in the whole concept of charting. It was very important to get on national charts and to, you know, chart in the top 10. You had the Contemporary Christian Music Magazine that really helped for many years to bring that all about and interview and do articles on a lot of the artists. Now, guess what's happened in light of all of that? Some people would say that it's desensitized, again, the quality of Christian radio because it seems to be hit-driven or maybe that some of these radio networks are going for the demographic of a certain age and gender. And so, again, you have people wanting to say, you know what, I'm just going to go back to the streets. For example, there's not a lot of the stations that would handle some of the genres such as punk rock or underground rock or rap. They'll stay more in the middle of the road and kind of, I guess you might say, be more sensitive to what they'll play. My radio show was dropped by some of the stations because I chose to play a couple of old Dylan songs and talk about his early faith in Christ. And they didn't want any Dylan on their station, and some of the stuff I was playing they thought a little bit too rocky, so they dropped the show. It's really not changed that much since 1972 in some places. It really hasn't. Isn't that funny?
So we have some that are a little more liberal, can we say, and some that are wanting to stay, that are accepting, except that they want to keep something of a conservative idea in there when it comes to what they're playing. Like you said, if it's too rocky, we're going to drop you. So now my question becomes, you know, the early days, again, you had Solid Rock Records with Larry Norman in the group, and, Mark Hurd, and then you had Amy Grant back in the late 80s go mainstream. You had Stephen Curtis Chapman and Michael W. Smith go more the worship route. pardon me. So we're seeing some of those changes there. And so what I'm wondering now, because as I listen to things like K-Love and WMBI, as you say, the Salem Radio Network, and one thing I know for sure that listeners miss is 20 The Countdown magazine. You mentioned that right quick. And maybe we can talk about that in a few minutes, about whatever happened to John Rivers and his show, if anybody knows where he's at and what he's doing. So with that, Jerry, maybe you can talk about some of that at the moment.
Well, again, I think you see this diversity coming in because they would say, you know, the big radio syndicates of several hundred stations are not open to play in my particular genre. And so they would go ahead and start a record company, not expecting to get a lot of airplay, but just selling the albums on the concert tour. And doing things in the area where there just wasn't any outlet. Of course, then after a while, some of that took off, and now we have contemporary worship stations, not inspirations like Moody Bible stations, where it's mostly teaching and, again, a lot of the older style music. But the new contemporary inspirational worship, we're talking, obviously, like Vineyard Music and Maranatha and the big conglomerate of music from Australia, Darlene Zelk. I can't say her last name, but you know what I'm talking about, that big group there out of Australia that has a particular style of music. And so now you see that some of the stations are leaning towards becoming full-time of that particular genre. And I think, again, what happens is the evolution of some of the early leaders seeing where the niche is and where the need is and eventually making the transition, John Rivers being one of those people. You know, he was the voice of Powerline, and he also did a lot of voiceovers and commercials, and 20 the Countdown was so popular. But he's actually become very involved in, you know, his own radio network. He's with KLTY that he helped to be a part of and create there in the area of his hometown. He lives out on a ranch. I see him every once in a while. He lives out there and has his studios. He can do his morning drive time right from his studio at the ranch, the River Ranch, I guess it is. And so just an amazing thing has happened with what he's done. And again, just taking the situation as it exists and making it work to fit his particular desire and need. I mean, wouldn't it be great if you could just get up in the morning and walk in the next room and there's your studio and you're heard around the country?
Absolutely. You know, I went to a station not long ago. I was invited there up in the city of Chicago. And I was told by one of the station managers giving us a tour that it's happening more and more where they just have the techs in the station to handle the things like the IT issues and the computers and make sure the right person pushes the right button so the commercials play at the right time and programming gets aired in the right time slot and everything. And I've been told that more and more people are working from home in this industry. Either the radio station is helping subsidize them or they were able to get their own equipment and they worked with the radio company to be able to broadcast from home and, as you said, do the drive time from the next room over. Do you think that's going to be more and more of a trend as time goes on and people become more concerned about spending time with family and spending less money on gas, traveling from work to back and so on?
Well, we all wish, but I don't think that you see that happen too often unless it's someone like I use this word with great admiration, a superstar like John Rivers, who was with K-Love for over 7 years doing that morning show and then left, you know. So, and I'm not fully aware of what he's doing presently in all of the stuff that he's doing, but he is so innovative. I'm sure he's on the cutting edge of the next thing. But that would be an exception. Most people don't have that particular opportunity to do that much. And then as they get older and they want to pass it on to others, I mean, Paul Baker is finally retired. He was one of the innovators of early Jesus Music Radio. We lost Tom Dooley, unfortunately, to cancer, and he is, again, a giant in the industry. And I really am trying to get as many interviews and remember some of those early times on the Full Circle Jesus Music Show, because we just lose so many as the years go by. And it's understandable that we can't always relive the era, but as long as we can, we certainly want to play the music where it all got started. See, there's a couple of reasons why I'm doing this syndicated show. And frankly, not a lot of the stations that I would like to be on are open to having me because I don't fit into their present demographics. I'd love to be on the Salem radio network or Caleb, and they just not been open to doing that at all, unless they maybe have a local program of their own. But I think it's necessary to have these classic oldie shows because people will forget where it all came from. They'll forget the grassroots. They won't understand, you know, the rich history and legacy that we have unless somebody reminds them. And I find that a lot of young people really love this music and really are intrigued about where it all started. And then, of course, there's some of the older folks that just don't listen to contemporary Christian radio anymore because it's not fitting their particular desire, and they love listening to the oldies and being reminded about where they first heard Randy Stonehill or first heard the second chapter of Acts, you know, and where they were at with the Lord in that particular time. So I would have to say to each his own, and we just keep doing what we're call to do. And I'm not sure, some people believe that Christian radio may be coming to an end someday in the fact of the economy and just trying to keep up with what's going on. Some people believe internet radio has a much better opportunity of taking over now in the next few years with the downloadability of so much internet radio onto your iPod or whatever, and we'll have to see how that all works. But there's certainly a shift going on, a transition of sorts. I'm sure of that.
Now, I remember, since you mentioned the first time someone heard a particular artist or a particular song, I was 12 years old. I was on my school bus. We had just turned the corner from the school to go down the main street from the school and start dropping people off on the school bus route there. And one of my older friends from the school, who was just a couple grades above me, played, Carry On Wayward Son by Kansas. And then after that happened to be Randy Stonehill's King of Hearts. That was the first two Christian music songs I ever heard.
Sure.
And then later on, as luck would have it, I would go to a camp as a kid that my church owned, and that was way up in northern Illinois, and I would meet Lisa Weyerhaeuser, who at that time was Lisa Stolberg and was still dating her husband now of many, many years. His name was Dan, and Dan was doing this magic act. He would come to the camp, and he would do this magic act for us kids every once in a while. And it was Lisa who taught me how to write and taught me how to use my voice. And I remember every night my love of radio, my love of writing would both always come back to me. And that would be the whole pattern throughout my life was radio and writing. So then as I got older, I realized who some of these people were from my childhood that I had actually had encounters with. And then you talk about now how everything is becoming centralized on the internet because of all the downloads, the ability to make it portable and take it with you, and so on. Do you think that's a good or a bad idea? From my perspective, I would say, as someone who's loved radio from the time I was little and has watched radio change over time, that it's more of a bad idea than a good one, because when radio relies on infrastructure such as the internet, that could be harmed, could be shut down, could be censored. or messed with in any other way, the level of credibility it has, as well as all of the different security holes that the internet will always have there. You're not going to be able to close those up completely unless you're just someone who does this sort of thing 24 hours a day. What do you think could be done in this context to keep real radio around?
Well, I do think that the Lord is still in charge, and I think that God wants us to come back to where it all started. That's why I keep going back to full circle. In that, what touches people's hearts the most, I believe, are the things that are from the heart, spontaneous, genuine, not contrived, not manipulated. And I think there's a lot of creativity still in the spirit of mankind. And if he's given half a chance, he'll express that in his art, his music, his worship. And that really is what keeps people alive when they have that opportunity. Internet radio may allow that kind of creativity without being structured or told to fit in certain genres or certain formats. And I think that in itself is appealing. Now, of course, we can see some things get out of hand too, because if it's not censored and it has a lot of freedom, there can be some mixture. There could be some leaven, so to speak, in the in the bread or in the loaf. You just have to trust that the Lord will give us wisdom to know where those balances are. Here's one that I think is the easiest to get hold of. Jesus said, "I don't do anything unless I hear my Father say it. I don't do anything on my own accord unless my Father's doing it. And I don't speak anything of my own initiative unless I hear my Father say." Boy, I tell you what, if we could follow that rule of thumb, we wouldn't have to worry anything about what the future is of Christian radio, because we would drop our agendas and we would just say only the things we hear the Father say. Probably have a lot more fruit and a lot more effectiveness. And there might be a few people out of jobs too. I don't know.
Now, bringing it in that direction, over the last several years, I want to say, and by several, I want to say maybe 4 years, 5 years, on two different occasions, we've had a more well-known pastor, everybody knows who he is, at WYFR Family Radio out in Okeechobee, Florida, predict the end of the world. He did it for a second time again. And so in that, we can talk about, too, how radio, especially some Christian broadcasters, not all of them, and some pastors have gotten on the air and they have maligned or misused or misinterpreted scripture, whether they meant it purposely or they were trying to make a political point or was done accidentally or what have you. What do you think in the realm of these things that's turning people off to faith-based radio? What do you think could change, and how do you think people could change that if you had to speak directly to those people that are being too much of the hell and brimfire and judgment type people on those stations?
Well, you know, I used to say this, that like in a church, the sheep vote with their feet. And people, if they're not fed and encouraged and edified by that, which is more of a, I don't know, I guess it's judgment when I say this, but some would say it's more fear tactics or more emotionally driven. But you're going to find most likely that the audience will be small and there won't be a lot of financial support coming in to keep it going, unless there's some, a few radical people have a lot of money and underwrite most of it. People will tune out, and I've had many people, I'll give you a couple of examples in these few moments that we have left. For example, I've talked to some young people, and I try to gauge what's going on in our society by, young people, and I find out that what they really want is the genuine. They're not really going to buy into things that have duplicity in them. And you'll find they'll check out pretty quick if they feel like there's manipulation and hype. They really want genuine in their relationships, in what they embrace in their faith. Case in point, we have three contemporary Christian radio stations in Nashville, and a couple of them are the big networks we've been speaking of. And I've asked several young people, hey, what station do you listen to out of the three the most? And here's what I've heard on a couple of occasions that really was quite eye-opening. Well, actually, we don't listen to any of them. Why? I know you guys love Jesus. Why are you not listening to contemporary Christian music radio? Well, because it feels like the music lacks passion and authenticity. Now, I realize that's an overstatement or a too generalized statement, but there's got to be some truth in it that some of today's music has become just without passion and authenticity. And so these folks are not listening to contemporary Christian music radio. Now, I do believe there's probably just as many people listening that are being blessed and edified, and they're supporting these listener-based networks because they are a part of that. I said it earlier, that age group or gender that they're focused toward. But I find a lot of Christians are not listening to Christian radio. They're just not. And so authenticity and intimacy will probably always rule. Eventually, people, you know, just get tired of it. You know, the flavor of the month, so to speak. And they're looking for something that's genuine and has a lot of authenticity. I would say without hesitation, one of the worship groups that I think has as much genuineness and authenticity than anyone is the highly popular Jesus Culture band out of Redding, California. And they are just going off the charts. Same thing with IHOP's music. And anybody that knows either one of those two ministries, one with Bill Johnson in Redding or Mike Bickle in IHOP in Kansas City, know the basis of that ministry, the foundation, is really as intimacy and authenticity as much as any place that you could look out there. And they would be a good example and model for a lot of us. So I think that's going to make a difference in the choices people make in the future as far as their choices with Christian radio.
Now, Mike Bickle, I met him. He is an awesome man, and I cannot believe that the International House of Pancakes has seen fit to sue that man for his name. Not related to this conversation, I just had to say it, because he's done so many wonderful things for the community. He's reached out to hundreds and thousands of people. I can only guess off the top of my head. You know,
well, let's hope that all gets worked out. They're certainly getting a lot of publicity, both of them, as a result of that. But let's just hope that it all works out, and I'm sure that God's will be done. I just believe it will.
So talk about, you know, being genuine and wanting authenticity without hype and something that's real. Jerry, you've been the real man in this industry doing what you do for a long time. It's from your heart. We hear it in your shows. I've heard it and seen it in your shows. And only recently have I really started paying attention to it. And so I want to say thank you for what you've done in being genuine and authentic with your programs and keeping the spirit and the artists and their music alive and the inspiration they bring to everybody from their different talents and their voices, their way of performing their styles and so on. So with that, Jerry, it's just been a privilege to have you here and to hear from you. You said a ton of valuable things. I hope that all of these things that we've talked about get to play out in the industry. because when it comes to AM, FM, and shortwave broadcasts, family broadcasts and faith-based radio is always going to be there. I know there's a lot of people down talking and saying, oh, we want to get rid of it. There's too much. Yeah, there's freedom of expression and freedom of religion. There's a lot of people saying to counter that we want freedom from religion. And I think religion has been one of the big problems is that in that they've been religious. One of the big things I've always heard the more real down-to-earth pastors say in real life is that God called us to be faithful. He didn't call us to be religious. He called us to believe in Him and to believe what He has said and to just trust Him with all of that. Jerry, again, you hit the nail right on the head. No pun intended there. It's been wonderful having you. And I hope to have you again sometime in the future. And I hope you pay attention to Shortwave America as we move on to bigger and better things here. And to have you here to kick it off, to be a part of the pilot episode, is just an honor. So thank you once more.
And again, thank you for this privilege and the kind things that you had to say. And I would appreciate your prayers that I will finish the race well. And only by His grace can any of us do that, because we're all human and we certainly have our failings. But it is my intent to finish the race well and represent this one who is the most amazing, kindest person in the universe. And He's well worth living our life wholly, completely for Him. God bless you and what you're doing. Occupy the planet.
Your driver. Look at the roughest side you ever had. I think it's bust out your windows, jimmy all your locks. Listen to the whisper when the spirit talks. Lay down your treasure, throw away your clocks. This is hallowed ground, do the spirit walk. Spirit walk. It's a road of uncertainty, and where it goes isn't guaranteed. Sometimes this old world can be unkind, but you can't ever leave my love. Can't ever leave my love. You can't ever leave my love behind. I'll meet you in the broken places, in the shadows of your pain, in a sea of strangers' faces. I will find you, stand beside you anytime you call my name.
The music montage you just heard over the last 5 minutes is the work of none other than the recent Christian Music Hall of Fame inductee, Randy Stonehill. Randy has been in the Christian music industry for 40 years. Born in what he calls Dusty Stockton in the United States West Coast state of California, he met up at the young age of 18 with the legendary Larry Norman. Randy now joins us via telephone from Minnesota. One of his earliest and most well-known songs talks about his experience with Larry. Randy, can you tell us what happened after that life-changing day in Norman's kitchen?
Yes, certainly. Well, and thank you, Dan, for having me on. Boy, everything changed after Norman's Kitchen and after Jesus came crashing into my life that day in June of 1970. You know, my vision of the world, my vision of myself was forever changed. But I still loved rock and roll. And Larry and I realized that we had the privilege and really the responsibility, in a way, of taking the living gospel of living hope to, you know, to our generation, who really wouldn't have thought to darken the doors of a church, but we knew that they would listen to rock and roll, just like we were. So we started writing songs about Jesus and how he was relevant to every part of culture and every part of our human journey.
Now, that had to have been quite some experience, being in the very beginnings of this music movement that would grow into a multi-billion dollar industry, having no idea where it was going to go, how it was going to be received. And you said yourself, when you were trying to wear your father down for a new guitar, and you told him, "Dad, this is what I want to do." And he said, "Son, this is such a cutthroat business, you know, it's going to break your heart." And you said, "I'm going to do this, whether I do it in front of the local store or in Carnegie Hall." And then you said you stopped and listened to yourself, and you realized the significance of that. Can you tell us a little bit about how that steered you?
You know, the funny thing is that a few years down the line, after taking a lot of heat from the traditional church who, you know, thought I was playing devil music, I realized that I was embracing something more than a vocation. I really was embracing a calling. And that was a sort of revelation knowledge moment for me, because I realized that, again, not only, you know, not only did I get to do this, but I remember having this conversation with God, you know, standing, leaning up against my car after a concert, and one particularly abrasive conversation with people who told me my hair was too long and my pants were too tight and my music was too loud and I was having too much fun. I just thought, you know, who needs this nonsense? You know, who needs this noise? I'm just going to go play rock and roll and make money and see the world. And I really felt the Holy Spirit saying, well, you can do that, and I gave you good gifts. You know, you might have a bit of success, but I promise you, you'll never be at peace because you are now a man who knows too much. And for you to hide the secret of God's love, for you to hide that under your hat and just leave the audience laughing every night when you could have shared hope, that's going to haunt you. It's going to haunt you every night of your life, every concert you do. And that's, like I said, I realized, wow, you mean I have to do this? Oh, wait a minute. I get to do this. Oh, wait a minute. I have to do this. So it was really interesting because I realized it wasn't going to be a picnic, but I had the privilege and in a way the challenge and the aggravation of what a poet once said, nothing beautiful is born without travail. So I was going, oh, okay, God, if you're going to lead in this, then you know it might be uphill sometimes, but I'll do it.
Well, Randy, now I can only imagine that created some conflict with you. I mean, as people are always somewhere in the world at some time in their lives trying to find themselves and their calling and figure out if they're going to follow their calling, how they're going to go about it, and what they're going to trust, and they're listening to as you said earlier in the interview, all this negative noise from people, and then you're always going to have a person or two that's going to support you. And then later in your life, you received a letter from the U.S. Department of, I guess they called it the U.S. Department of War back then. You were drafted, and you realized that you weren't meant for a uniform and a gun, as you said. You were in a place to bring hope and life and positivity to people's lives. How did that affect you in the middle of your, or I should say in the middle of the beginning of your music career?
Well, again, that was a challenge that God used to speak to my heart about what my real commitment was. And I remember going in front of the standing before the draft board in San Jose, California, with my first little record called Born Twice that Larry and I had recorded for $800, and by golly, it sounded like every penny of that $800, let me tell you, Dan. It was decidedly lo-fi, but it had heart. So anyway, I stood there before the draft board and I said, look, you know, I'm a Christian. I believe that I could do more, I could be more beneficial stateside sharing God's love and God's hope with people. I could be better use, so to in other words, I could be of better use to the country doing that than stumbling through the jungle with a rifle in my hand. And knowing what a goofy kid I was anyway, you know, it's like my mom and dad were looking at each other going, oh, man, this kid's going to get, he's going to be dead so quickly. He's just, you know, he's going to be like looking at a butterfly or something, and he's going to get shot, you know. So interestingly enough, the Lord let me find favor with the draft board, and 3 out of 4 of them voted to offer me a conscientious objector status. And but they said, but you still have to do, you're still required to do 2 years or more of service, like in a hospital or something here in the States. And I said, well, okay, I will follow your directive. And right around that time, the government initiated the lottery system, which is, you know, as you probably know, where you kind of draw straws, you know, and if you have they allot you a various number whereby you can be brought into service or not. And if your number was high enough, then it was very unlikely that you'd ever be called to serve in any fashion. And so I was watching this transpire, and ended up getting an extremely high number, which meant that I was pretty much out of the woods, out of the running. And so I you know, I held it with a loose grip before the Lord, and I thanked him, and I just went on writing my songs and playing, you know, playing and singing about Jesus wherever I could.
So your career moves forward from there, and you get discovered by Mer Records, which was a division of Word Incorporated. How did that happen?
Well, I had a tenure with, you know, with Larry Norman. I guess the first thing that happened was Larry and I recorded Born Twice, using a little bit of money that the wonderful Mr. Pat Boone had loaned to us. From there, I ended up getting a record deal in London with Phonogram Records in 1973. It was short-lived. I did a record I didn't particularly even like, but I learned a lot from the experience. I came back to the States, and Larry Norman had started another company called Solid Rock, and he was able to get an international distribution deal with Word Records. And after my time with Larry, the people at Mer, that West Coast division of the company, called me up, and they said, look, we know that you're just about to be out of your contract with Solid Rock, and frankly, we love what you do. We just think that you're the best kept secret, so to speak, in rock and roll. In other words, we could do a much better job of making your music visible. And I think their timing was a combination of, you know, it was godly timing, but they were also being pretty savvy. I think they knew that I was about to, my contract with Larry was about to lapse. And though I had a love and respect for Larry, he was a very unique character and not the best of businessmen. So it was fun recording with him, but Solid Rock Records was pretty fast and loose as a record company. And I thought, you know, this is not good stewardship. I love Larry, but I should not stay in this creative pond. So I was ready. I was feeling God telling my heart to move on, though I had no idea what I would do. And then the people at Mer said, look, come aboard with us. Let us, you know, let us promote your records like they should be promoted. And so I signed with them in, I think, 1979.
Now, there was just an awesome thing to have happened because, you know, as we know the way these contracts work, you come to the end and either the person is or the company is going to renew your contract or they're not, and then, as you just stated, you're in a place where you have no idea what you're going to do. So this happens for you. And you released your first album in, must have been 1980 or 81, called Between the Glory and the Flame. But on Welcome to Paradise, you created a lot of songs, most of which have never died. Can you tell us about, first, the songs Keep Me Running and King of Hearts from Welcome to Paradise?
Well, yeah, let me say that I view that whole project as something that you can only describe as a project whereby the sum is greater than the individual parts. In other words, I think that the Lord allowed that creative and spiritual vision to come into focus at a crucial crossroads time in the culture, where people really did need to hear the gospel, you know, in a passionate and personable way, and it needed to be just something that was artistically competitive with what was happening in the mainstream. And I don't know, I always look back at that project and feel like God's hand was, you know, was really at work in it, even beyond my understanding. All I knew about my job as a songwriter was just to try to share my heart and write songs that, again, would demonstrate how Jesus was intimately acquainted with and profoundly, you know, relevant to, you know, every part of the journey. So But yeah, each of those songs does have a story. And King of Hearts, for instance, was something that came to me as I was sitting in my apartment on Otsego Street in North Hollywood one evening. And I was actually thinking about how much I enjoyed the Eagles. And I thought, you know, now if the Eagles were Christians, maybe they'd write something like this. It would be cool. And it would have a cool guitar hook, maybe like this. And as I started playing that guitar hook, I thought, wow, in my opinion, that is cool. And that song fell into place, and it was really about the Hound of Heaven, you know, how we are haunted by our longing for hope, because that's how God built us. And you know, and because of our fallen nature, we run away from the very hope that we need, and yet God in his grace continues to, you know, to lovingly kind of nip at our heels. So that was the impetus for that song. And King of Hearts is a very special story for me, because I really, it's out of all the things I've written, I really have to testify and say that I felt God almost steering my pen. Yeah, I don't say stuff like that casually. I mean, I've written for 40 years, and I can count on the fingers. I can count on less than the fingers of one hand the times I've experienced that. I was again sitting in that same apartment, and I was thinking about a young lady that I'd been dating that I was getting pretty serious about. And I thought, you know, maybe I could write a song that would really kind of seal the deal here, you know. It's like she'd go, oh, my goodness, he's masculine yet sensitive. I came up with this pretty guitar, the sunlight in her hair and the music of her laughter and stuff. But as I was doing that, I felt the pen almost pulling in another direction. Like, and I'd stop myself and I'd look at the paper and I'd say, no, okay, let's think about this girl. Let's stay on task. And yet the lyrics kept on coming out in another direction. After about 30 minutes of that struggle, it dawned on me, and I realized that the Lord was, or I should say, I felt as if the Lord was saying, now, young man, if you want to write an authentic love song, why don't you put the horse before the cart, so to speak, and write about the author of love. And, man, I threw my pen up in the air and started laughing, and I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do. This song is a real love song, and it's dedicated to the King of Hearts. And I wrote that lyric in about 30 minutes.
You're right. That kind of inspiration, that kind of happening, doesn't happen that often. So then 1981 comes around, and Between the Glory and the Flame is released. How did Word Records deal with that with you?
I felt like they were pretty generous and supportive, but the record company was, I mean, the record business was starting to become very fast-paced. Their own roster was getting, more and more extensive. And so the good news was they gave me a respectable budget, and they committed to some marketing money. But the other news was that commitment was actually for a very limited period of time. So in other words, they would beat the drum and work the project for maybe 2 or 3 months, and then they would move on because they had other artists whose work they needed to promote. So, you know, so you'd get a little bit of a jump start, but beyond that, I started to recognize quickly that they were really counting on the artist to be the living commercial for the work, and just to, you know, to do the heavy lifting of promotion just by being out on the road, you know, perennially. And that was okay with me because, I mean, I love the road and I, you know, I love doing what I do. But yeah, but I started to get the sense that it was, you know, kind of truck tires on a gravel road. You know, there's a lot of spinning, but not a lot of momentum. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to write new material and I'll go better.
That they give you this respectable budget and you go through all this. You create one of the best works in everybody's opinion who's ever listened to your music. Every album you've done surpasses the next, and they've all got their favorite albums or favorite songs. How was between Welcome to Paradise and Between the Glory and the Flame in that time in your career and your life, how was the radio stations receiving this?
I think the radio network was still in its fledgling stages. I mean, there was a good deal of enthusiasm. Radio was in its fledgling stages back then. There wasn't a big infrastructure, but at least we didn't garner an indifferent response. You know, I think there was probably a polarization in terms of the mentality. Some radio that was out there would not play this kind of music. It was more focused on traditional, you know, gospel music, or on you know, radio. I mean, on spoken sermon. But new blood was coming along and starting to be positioned in radio, and that generation, maybe my generation, was figuring out, was recognizing what an important voice for the gospel this music was. So there was controversy, but there was growing interest, and it was always it was spotty, but it was exciting to start to hear some of the songs on the radio. But again, it was everything was at the ground floor stage back then.
So as your career advances from there, I know you've had your own experiences with radio stations and the different interview personalities. You've been all over the world. Tell us your observations on the world of CCM and Christian radio broadcasting through there. Are there any memories that you have that specifically stick out?
Well, yeah. I will say this, that as the movement continued to grow, the radio, you know, network became more expansive. And that was a good news, bad news scenario, in that there was more radio muscle to get the music out there, but in short order, I can't help but feel that it got sort of co-opted, you know, by record companies who were saying, well, look, you know, we need you to play these specific songs. If you want a good relationship with us, these are the songs you will promote. There were, as a matter of fact, there was a certain radio consultant who shall remain nameless, who really became the go-to guy. So there was a consolidation of power that took away a lot of the diversity and liberty of what could happen in radio. He was the guy who had, you know, who would, the record companies would talk to, and he in turn would talk to the radio stations, and all of a sudden, you know, it's what he said was law. So all of a sudden the radio format got more and more constricted and more conscious about just how to make the quickest amount of profit that they could. So it was almost like the commerce mentality put a stranglehold on what could have been, I think, a much more effective ministry tool for the kingdom. And you know, I'm sorry, that's a long answer to your question. And actually, you didn't even ask that one. Hey, think of it as a bonus, Dan. I'm just saying. I saw how a good thing started to grow, and then I think kind of unraveled, and that made me sad and frustrated. But in terms of my own radio experience, on a positive note, I remember being invited to be a part of a live nationwide broadcast, and I believe the man was, I believe his name was Bob Sowers, and he had this situation set up whereby you could go in and be interviewed and perform live for a small studio audience, but then it was broadcast nationwide in real time. And I think that happened when I was promoting, it's been many records, my brother. It was the record that Faithful was on. Let me see. That
Until We Have Wings?
It might be Until We Have Wings.
Yeah, it was 1990 when you released that.
Okay. Yeah, maybe that was Until We Have Wings. It was half studio, half live, that project. And, but I remember, you know, being called by the record company saying, hey, we're going to fly you out to, I think it was in Virginia, I don't even remember now, but we're going to fly you out, and you're going to be on this program, and it's a great ministry moment and a great moment to promote the new music. And so I got to the studio, we went on the air, and then Bob Sauer said, Randy, how does it feel to be performing live for approximately 1.5 million people? And I just smiled and I said, well, Bob, you know, the radio listeners can't see this, but right now I'm so nervous and pumped. I have happy feet. I could break into interpretive praise dance right now. And anyway, but it was a very fun evening, and then they had some surprise callers phone into the program to say hello and to encourage me, and one of them was my sweet friend Amy Grant.
It was 1985 when you and Amy were almost given a Grammy Award. How did that happen?
That's right. Well, you know what they say, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, Dan. But yeah, you know, Amy and I were on tour. She invited me to be a part of the last third of the Straight Ahead tour, and that was big fun. And she's great company. She's such a genuine Christian and just a genuine lady. On that tour, I sat her down in the back of the tour bus one evening, and I said, hey, I wrote this song, and I just always loved your voice, because I can always hear your heart in your voice. Would you consider recording it with me as a duet for the next record? And she was so sweet. She sat in the back of the bus while I sang and played, and she closed her eyes, and she kind of rocked back and forth in her seat. And when I was done, she looked at me, and she smiled, and she said, gee, I'd love to record that with you. It was a song called I Could Never Say Goodbye, you know, just about, you know, primal bonding that comes with your heart and the Holy Spirit. And a few months later, we went into the studio and put it together. Then the phone rang one afternoon, and I picked it up, and it was the man from the record company said, hey, you and Amy have been nominated for a Grammy for best vocal, by a group or a duet. Would you be in town for the show in February? I said, I will certainly make a point to be, you know, why? And they said, well, because not only are you invited to wear your tuxedo and come to the Grammys, But this year, the contemporary Christian music category is going to be it's going to be on camera. It's going to be broadcast, you know, live. And I just, man, I could feel my whole face just go red. And I said, well, sir, you can rest assured that I will be there. So, so I sat nervously in the fourth row and thought, you know, I was pretty sure that we were going to win, and that was not the case. Larnell Harris and Patty, I almost got it right. A lot of jet lag. Sandy Patty and Larnell Harris won the Grammy. But the funny thing is, I almost started to stand up because they said, "And the winner is I," you know, which is of course how my song title starts. I could never say goodbye. And he says, "And the winner is I've just seen Jesus, Sandy Patty and Larnell Harris." So I started to stand up, and I went, "Oh, I think I'll sit back down."
To get that far is a milestone for anybody. And
yeah, it was a real honor. And my folks flew from San Jose to Los Angeles, and so they were sitting in the audience. Amy couldn't make it that night because she was rehearsing for the Unguarded tour. But I did. I'll never forget the camera swinging, you know, swinging in my direction as they started to play a little snippet of the song. And I got to wink. I winked at America. So I was on camera in front of, as a matter of fact, not just America. It was, I guess, global. I was on camera in front of 50 million viewers for, you know, 4 seconds or something. So that was, it was a unique kind of surreal experience, and certainly a growth experience, because it also reminds you of what the real definition of success is. And a Grammy is a wonderful thing, but real success is just serving God wherever He allows it.
Now, you spoke on stage a few seconds later in your career. You played with Odin Fong. I don't remember where exactly this concert took place, and you had been nominated, just like you had been, I believe, at least probably two or three other times, for the Christian Music Hall of Fame. And you spoke about how it's a privilege and an honor, but it's also a double-edged sword, because you have these people that are, you know, judging your body of work and so forth. So how did that go for you?
Yeah, that was a special time. I was given I was inducted into the Christian Music Hall of Fame, if that's what you're referring to, and it was filmed by the TBN network. So they play it and replay it incessantly, which is fine with me. I think it is a two-edged sword, in that it's a blessing and a privilege to do what you love, and it's certainly a privilege to have any participation at all in God's eternal purposes. So it's pretty wonderful to just watch Him, you know, at work in my little song. It's also a bit strange because the world is full of critics. That reality just teaches you, I think, to develop a sort of a healthy, you know, kind of spiritual thick skin. You know, you have to look at it and say, well, there's always going to be somebody that doesn't like what you do, or it's not their cup of tea, but that's okay. If they can hear my passion for Christ and they can see that I'm really taking that I have enough faith and enough heart to take a chance and just, you know, embrace my own creative expression, then hey, if they don't like it, that's okay. I don't need to be loved by everybody. I would hope that they'd respect me for my authenticity, though.
That, Randy, is classically like you, because you've never wanted to be put on a pedestal. And during your career, though, you've had several number one radio hits. I remember your last radio hit, was I Thirst For You from the Stories album, which was your final album with Word Records. Can you tell us a little bit about that song and your other number one radio hits and how that played a role in your relationship as a Christian music artist with the radio industry?
Yeah. Well, yeah, that song in particular is one of those happy blessings where you feel that the chorus sort of just drops into your lap. I remember when I was living on the West Coast in Seal Beach, I was out jogging on the beach, and I got that chorus lyric and melody running through my head, and I jogged home and I sat down and I sang it into a cassette recorder, and lo and behold, by God's grace and a lot of studio perspiration, it did become a number one. And you know, I mean, that's always good because it gets the heads of the powers that be to, you know, turn in your direction. You know, radio remembers that you're still there, you're doing, you know, viable work. It gets an audience to pay attention, and that just helps with visibility. But yeah, actually, I had several more number one records after that recording. So, you know, what can I say? That's I think it has to be the right song in the right season, and you never know when it's going to happen, but you're always blessed when it does. And of course, it makes me feel good that it's helpful that radio, like I said, you know, still looks at you as a viable contender, and so they will be willing to play the music and to step it up into hotter and hotter rotation as the audience responds.
What were some of your other number one radio hits, Randy, other than I Thirst For You? I remember in 1994 you created with Holly Benyuski and the group out in Indiana in that little office that you spent so much time conversing with and visiting off and on as you were in the area. You created the Solid Rock Records label again to keep that name alive and keep your career afloat when Mer Records and Word had let you go. What was that like, creating the work of The Lazarus Heart and songs like Shadow Man and some of the other songs on there?
Well, you know what? First, let me gently correct you. That was called Street Level... I should need to correct myself. Street Level Records, I believe.
Yes, that was Street. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. Boy, yeah.
No, but that's all right. There ain't no law, Dan. You can get it wrong. Yeah, it was Street Level Records, and with Ray Ware and Holly Benyuski and Gavin Morkel, and that was, you know, that was great. Just putting together our little guerrilla operation with with people that I had a lot of history with, like Holly and like Ray in particular. And I was very proud of how that record came together. Had the wonderful Jimmy Lee Sloss, who produced PFR and played bass for Garth Brooks and for Michael W. Smith. He was wearing the producer hat. Just had a wonderful time with him. And, you know, it's funny because I could also, as I listen back to some of those songs, which I do on occasion, I recognize that God was continuing to stir me and help me grow up, and I felt like I had deeper things to say, but really found the musical voice with those players, you know, like Stephen Brewster on drums, Jerry McPherson, who played with Amy Grant, you know, on guitar. And yeah, and by God's grace, man, we had four hit singles from that record. We had, Promise Made is a Promise Kept, I Turn to You, and In Jesus' Name, which I did as a duet with Michael W. Smith. And at least I know we had at least those three. So, but that was a growth experience, and it's also it's one of those situations where when you look over your shoulders, 10 or 15 years down the line, I can still listen to that record and feel that the writing and the recording holds up, still holds its own.
At that point, you were more than just a hat of a writer and a performer. You were the president of Street Level Records, the CEO. You also worked with Julie Miller. Now, did you produce that album that she did, her flagship album, with that label, or how did that go?
Yeah, no, I didn't, though I did have the blessing of working with Buddy and Julie Miller as a tour team. That was special. Those are both special people and very special talents. And I had to say that, I was the head of the company, but I can't help but feel more like Queen Elizabeth. You know, I was, though I don't wear the dress and the crown, if you catch my meaning. Like I said, I had the title of being the president, but I really still needed to leave the heavy lifting to people like Ray Ware and Holly, and I was very busy, being on the road and writing and recording. I think we felt it was important that people saw me as the president, even though I was obviously part of the decision making, process. But it was important for people to see me as the president so that they would understand that this wasn't just a company run, by some corporate mentality, but it was a company for artists, run by an artist.
So what happened with Street Level Records in the end, and how did it end up folding?
Well, it's just part of that that dysfunctional, convoluted story of life in the music business. We had a partnership with Gavin Markle, who was doing quite well growing and running REX Records. And so as we piggybacked sort of onto his machinery, he made the fatal mistake of creating a relationship with another company whose name shall remain obscure right now. And unfortunately, it turned out to be a hostile takeover on their part. The ugly business details are something that are a bit beyond my grasp, but what looked to be a wise idea to connect what we were all doing with the bigger machine turned out to be a fatal mistake. And like I said, the company that we got connected with really put a stranglehold on the whole thing. And so, unfortunately, what we had was a very good record and some really good radio success and no marketing money. The marketing money all dried up, and the company had to fold.
That must have been upsetting for you. How did you look at that, and at what point did you say, my career moves on, but in a different direction, and I need to build new relationships, and I need the help of the radio community to do it. I need to keep creating music and getting them to play it. How did all that go?
There was a lot of prayer. I just had to put one foot in front of the other. I had to look over my shoulder and recognize that God had brought me, this far down the road, and that he was faithful, even though people quite often were not. And so it actually brought me to a place where I just had to keep my eyes fixed on his character and listen for his voice, and that's, of course, the best directive that I could ever offer up to anybody for anything. So I remember sitting with, with my dear friend and manager, Ray Ware, and saying, well, God is still God. This didn't take him by surprise. We made a record we were proud of, and we're we're still passionate about serving the Lord. So let's go cast our musical bread upon the waters. And we ended up actually connecting with Brentwood Records, who signed me for a season anyway. And I was able to work with Elias and put out a record called Thirst. And from that record, we had at least one number one single, maybe the last one I had, called Hand of God. So, you know, you just go, well, these doors are closing, but if we just keep faithfully walking with the Lord and not getting ahead of him with our fears or with our dreams, we'll just see what other doors he opened. So he opened that one, and I did have another season of success.
To be in the footshoes of somebody that can go from one door closing into another one, it's just simply not something that happens for everybody. Having been raised in the church, I can tell you stories, although not here, from my life and the life of other people that operated on faith, thinking that door was going to open and putting the horse before the cart and doing just all the things you said to do, and the doors don't open. So for that to have happened for you was definitely the story of God himself having favor on you, I think. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I do too. I concur. He's just gracious, you know, beyond what we expect and beyond what we deserve. And, you know, and ultimately when the whole world gets turned upside down on you, everything can change, but God doesn't change. And that's the most valuable lesson I've learned on this whole roller coaster trip in the music business. And, you know, it's funny because now in this season of my life, I've just been, you know, working and recording independently. And, you know, but it's so funny because, like I said, you look at the situation and people go, record companies, they treat us like an afterthought. We're working for the man. This is bondage. And then things like the internet happens, and all of a sudden, record companies are, you know, are becoming almost obsolete. So you just never know what God is going to do. But my wife and I have found that as we continue to put God squarely in the middle of everything, from our relationship to our finances to our creative dreams, he continues to make a way where quite often you would think there is no way. And I have to say too, as I look back, you know, I really do think that God in his largesse just let me find favor, because, you know, I'm not a spiritual giant. Though I'm probably more passionate about my relationship with Christ now than I ever have been. But I watched so many of my peers fall to the wayside just in terms of their careers. I watched them, you know, be cut loose by record companies. I watched them become bitter and cynical. And many of them got out of music altogether. It's like they allowed the disappointments of the world to quench their sense of calling. And I'm very grateful to God that he always kept me kind of simple enough and positive enough because of his love that he kept me going. So blessings to you. Appreciate your hard work and your vision for how God can speak through the conduit of modern technology and through his timeless gift of music. Yeah, and so, like I said, you know, blessings to you. Press on in faith. Let's do this some more anytime you'd like.
Ladies and gentlemen, Randy Stonehill. And that's all the time we have for this first episode of Shortwave America. Thank you to our listeners and our fans, our followers, for listening for the last 51 minutes and 49 seconds. Special thanks to Jerry Bryant and Randy Stonehill for making this episode happen, for taking time out of your busy schedules to be here and support this first episode. You guys are the best. You're appreciated, and I wish you the best for all time. On the next Shortwave America show, Paulette McQuarrie will be our guest host as we talk about 30 years of space shuttle communications history. See you then. Bye-bye.